nanohub.org. You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
So today I'd like to continue this discussion from the last class, which is, as you know, last day I think I handed out just a page of summarizing these equations. And like what we're doing, going to talk about today is where these equations come from. And this is kind of basic in the sense that if you're trying to calculate current, like in this quantum transport theory, these are the basic equations. That it doesn't matter what device we are talking about, is it something complicated, something simple, what we are talking about. Regardless of that, the point is there will be a H matrix, that's this Hamiltonian matrix, which describes the channel. Then there will be a sigma 1 and a sigma 2, which connects it to the contacts. If you happen to have more than two contacts, there will be a few more sigmas. There will be a sigma 3 and a sigma 4, etc. And H is a Hermitian matrix whose eigenvalues are all real, while these sigmas are not necessarily Hermitian. In fact, they have an anti-Hermitian component, which is what you call this gamma matrix, because gamma, you'll notice, is proportional to sigma minus sigma dagger. And if this were a Hermitian matrix, it would have been zero, because Hermitian means that it's conjugate transpose, which is what this dagger represents. So Hermitian means that the conjugate transpose is the same as the matrix itself. So if sigma were Hermitian, this would have been zero. And physically, of course, this gamma is related to how easily electrons get in and out of your channel. Because as you might expect, when you're calculating current flow, that is a key quantity. And in this sense, the problem we are discussing is very different from most of the problems that people usually deal with in the context of quantum mechanics, in the context of Schrodinger equation. Most of the time, people are talking about, say, ground state energy of some isolated system. That, like if you took a course in nanomaterials, the problems you'd be discussing is why a certain type of structure wants to form, why it has a lower energy than other structures, etc. So those are all isolated systems. You're talking about the overall energy of that system. On the other hand, in this class, of course, it's really about transport. Transport meaning how electrons get from left to right. And while this H is an important part in the sense it describes the dynamics of your channel through which the electrons go, it basically tells you, you know, how many lanes on your highway, how fast, what the speed limit, things like that. That's what this H is about. But then you also have to worry about how electrons actually come into that channel and how they actually get out. And that's the sigma 1 and the sigma 2. And once you have that, then there is this Green's function that you can calculate. You can find the anti-Hermitian part of this Green's function. That's what's called the spectral function. Now, physically, what it means is it's like the density of states. So in other words, if you knew H and sigma, and if you did this, this A that you'd get, that's a matrix. But if you looked at its diagonal elements, it would give you the density of states. Then this next line, again, the technical name is, they call it the correlation function. But what it physically what it is like electron density. Remember, there's this distinction between density of states and electron density. Density of states tells you whether states are available or not. That's like, again, how many lanes on your highway. Electron density means how many cars are actually in those lanes. They could be empty, they could be filled, etc. That's the G sub n. Yeah, that's the G super n here. That's it. And then the current, which is usually what you're most interested in. You're trying to calculate the current. So that's current, that's electron density, that's density of states. Okay. Now, so these are the basic equations you'd be using, no matter what device you're talking about. And one device to another, what really changes is just how you write down these matrices. So if it's a simple thing, it might be a little easier to write it down. If it's something complicated, one might have to spend more time trying to write down the matrices. But once this could include spin as well. You know, one of the things we'll be talking about a couple of weeks later is about devices where spin transport is important. But the basic equations are still the same. All that will change is how you write the matrices, what you do with it, etc. But the basic equations are still the same. So what we are doing now in this one or two lectures then is what I'll be trying to tell you is where these equations come from. Okay? And then later on it would be more like, how do I use these equations? Okay. Now, these are very general, as I said. Doesn't matter how complicated the device. But in trying to understand it or where it comes from, it's useful to start from a relatively simple device. Because then you can kind of see how it works, and then you can do the more general thing. Okay? And so for the simple device, what I said is, let's consider just a 1D wire, which is represented with a discrete lattice like this. You can number them 0, 1, 2, 3, etc. And at the end of it, there's a contact someplace. So if I had to write down the matrix for this, the Hamiltonian matrix for this whole thing, as you know, the way it would look like is you'd have some diagonal element, call that epsilon, and some thing that couples it to the nearest neighbors. And to follow the notation in the book, I'll write this as minus T0. Because usually, in order to represent a wire whose EK relationship looks like this, you need a T that is negative. I mean, that coupling element that is negative. So it's convenient to write it as negative of something so that something is a positive thing. Okay? Because if you don't have this negative, if it's a positive thing, then what would happen is the dispersion relation would have looked like that, which would have been more appropriate for a valence band, for example. Because it would be curving downwards. Because, as we discussed, the EK relationship looks something like epsilon. And the way I have written it, it would be minus 2T0 cosine KA. The way I've written it with the minus T0, it would look like that. What that means is, right at KA equal to 0, that's where this quantity is a maximum, it's 1. And so the overall energy is a minimum because of that minus sign. On the other hand, if this thing has been positive, then at k equals 0, you'd have got its maximum. It would have looked more like that. Right? That's it. Okay. So what I'll assume is this is a negative quantity and write it that way. Okay. Now, if you were to write down the equations here, what we are trying to do then is kind of draw a line here, call this the device H, and try to come up with an appropriate sigma 1 and an appropriate sigma 2. Now, in practical problems, again, one of the important questions is, where exactly do you draw the line? Okay? And this is where the basic idea is that you should draw the line at a point where you think that in this part, things are reasonably in equilibrium. Because what we are going to assume is that this part, the electron energy distribution is given by a Fermi distribution, that equilibrium distribution. So that's the guideline. Now, exactly where you draw it in a real device, that requires discussion. Okay? So at this time, I'm just trying to show you the principle of how you get to those equations. So I'm just drawing the line here so that the actual device has only 2 points. 1 and 2. Now, in principle, this could have 10 points, could have 100 points. But once you see how to do it with 2, I think you'll see the basic idea. So let's just do it 2 points. Now, as we started to do the last day, the basic equation then would have looked something like E psi 1 is equal to epsilon psi 1 minus T 0 psi 2 minus T0 psi 0. and E psi 2 is equal to minus T0 psi 1 plus epsilon psi 2 minus T0 psi 3. So those are just the straight difference equations. I've not done anything so far. It's just that whatever you'd have written down, if you had written down a matrix, this is what you'd have got. That E times, you stand at any point psi 1, E psi 1, equals epsilon psi 1 minus T0, something to the right, minus T0, something to the left. E psi 2, epsilon psi 2, minus T0, psi to the left, minus T0, psi to the right. And what we are trying to do after this is get rid of those two things. Because my device, I'd like to think of it as points 1 and 2, which means I want to keep track of psi 1 and psi 2, what the psi is inside my device, but I really don't want to keep track of what it is elsewhere. I want to get rid of this contact. So I want to get rid of the psi 0 and psi 3. That's what we'll be trying to do here. Okay. Now, the way you do this is, say that once you come to the edge here, if this is a uniform wire like this, then by the time you come here, the wave looks like just something that is going out in that direction, and we'll call that tau e to the power plus ikx. It's something that has only an outgoing wave. There is no incoming wave once you get to that side. Because the physical problem we are considering is one where something comes in from here. Take this sigma 1 and sigma 2 out of here. We have something that comes in here and something that gets reflected. So you could call the reflection, say, rho e to the power minus ikx. What comes in, I'll call it some amplitude A, which we'll discuss later, plus ikx. So the picture we have in mind, electron is coming in from here, turns around, gets reflected, some of it gets transmitted. Okay. Now, since out here you only have a transmitted wave, then as we discussed, you could write psi 3 as simply psi 2 times e to the power ika. Because you could write psi 2, let us say, as tau e to the power plus ik times 2a, and psi 3 is equal to tau e to the power plus ik times 3a, which means you could write psi 3 as psi 2 times e to the power ika. So this is what we had done last day. So the assumption is, at the end of the device, by the time you get here, there's no reflected waves at all. Regardless of the details of the device, that's like what the contact looks like. Electrons just go out, nothing comes back. That's it. That's that. Okay. So that allows me then to get rid of this psi 3 and put a psi 2 e to the power ika. And what we'll be doing now is trying to figure out how to get rid of this psi 0 the same way. That's it. Now, this is a little harder because if you write psi 0, how much is it? Can you help me? Remember, the way I wrote this is, just put x equals 2a for point 2, x equals 3a for point 3. That's it. So what happens here? I put, for psi 0, I put x equals 0. So I got an incident wave and a reflected wave, and so how much is it? Just a plus rho. Done. And if I want to write psi 1, it will look like a e to the power plus ika plus rho e to the power minus ika. So what I need to do now is, again, just as I wrote psi 3 in terms of psi 2, I want to write psi 0 in terms of psi 1. Yes, please.
Why is it A plus 2, why not A minus 2?
I am just putting x equal to 0.
Yeah, but the rho is to a minus I kx in the other direction. So,
right.
Getting added,
right, but it is... So if you, as a mathematician, the way you'd have written the function is as a sum of two terms. So if I had to, if you ask me what is the wave function here, I'd say it is this plus this. And then you are bringing in this physical interpretation that those two terms, this one represents something to the right, this one represents something to the left. That's just your physical interpretation, which requires this, all this idea behind it, namely, that this EK relation looks like this, and for any K, the direction it moves is the group velocity, which is dE/dK, and it happens to be positive here and negative here. So if you have a e to the power ikx, that represents going this way, etc. All that is kind of built into drawing those arrows. But it need not figure into the mathematical reasoning at all. Right? That's just the physics you have to have behind it. Yeah. Say this again.
Why the reflected wave is rho and not a rho?
We could have defined it as a rho also. And probably we could have defined this as a tau in that case. Right? That is true. Right. So, because if you define this as a transmission coefficient, then you should take the incident wave and multiply it by the transmission, which is what you are saying. Right. Here, all I did was just gave it a name. We could. Because one of the issues I'll get into after this is how to figure out the A, what A should be. Yeah.
So, why is the at the one end just there's a reflection and there's no reflection at the another end? So.
Oh, and what happens is the physical problem we are discussing is that an electron comes from the left and nothing comes from the right. Right, right. And one of the very important physical points is that when you have waves from both sides, you should not add the size from the two. You should add the psi star psi, which is why it's important to do those two problems separately, find the psi, and actually add the psi star psi. This is a very important physical point, again, right, which I'll get to later. So, in this discussion, then, if you think of where you're getting going here, usually with current, there is something from the left that you proportional to F1, something from the right that's proportional to F2, right? This, the Fermi function on the left determines what's coming in. Fermi function from the right determines what's coming in at a given energy. And in a way, the problem we are doing, you could say, is when F2 is equal to 0, F1 is equal to 1, let's say. So electrons are coming in from the left. Nothing is coming in from the right. That's the problem we're doing. And the important thing is that when you have electrons coming in from both sides, you should really be superposing not the wave functions, but the psi star psi. Okay? And that needs more discussion that I'll get to. OK, so yeah, very good questions. Yes, please go ahead. Of the two, that, for example, one of them is not blocked by exclusion principle because of the, right? That is another issue that needs more discussion. Yes, but that is true. As long as transport is coherent, which means there is no other scattering, as long as electrons flow coherently, and what that means is, according to Schrodinger equation, without interacting with the surroundings, here, that statement I can justify. I can justify that what comes from the left and what comes from the right will not suffer any exclusion principle due to each other. I mean, one will not stop the other. But that's a very important physical point, too. Yeah. Okay. So So the problem we are discussing here then is that, yeah, you have an incident wave from the left, and so some of it gets reflected, and some of it gets transmitted. And the only reason I don't have a wave going this way here is because nothing comes in from the right. I could have been solving a whole different problem where something comes in from the right, and there's a reflected wave to the right, and something is transmitted. That's a different problem I could have been doing. And the two are separate problems that have to be done one by one. Okay, so here then, the question is, how do I write psi 1 in terms of psi 0? And one way to do this would be, or rather, the other way around. I want to write psi 0 in terms of psi 1. So what I could do is, I could say psi 0 is equal to e to the power plus ika times psi 1, right? Because from here, if I just multiply with a e to the power ika, what would happen is I'd get a 2 there, and this would go away. So what I'd e to the power ik times psi 1 would be rho plus a e to the power i2k. So, which isn't exactly psi 0. Psi 0 is rho plus a. Okay? But what I could do then is add a and take away e to the power i2k times a. So because this has this a e to the power i2ka in it, so let me subtract out the a e to the power i2ka from it and add in the a, and then I've got it right. Okay? But the thing is, now I have a relation between psi 0 and psi 1, and I could interpret this as a source term. See? Because if you remember, what I had said last day was that the usual Schrodinger equation looks like EI minus H times psi equals 0. And normally the way you think about it is that unless the energy matches one of the eigen energies of H, you cannot find a non-trivial solution. That's the way Schrodinger equation is normally used. We are trying to do an open system, and that makes two differences. One is you pick up this sigma here, and secondly, you have a source term here. Okay? And what I'm trying to show you with a simple example is how, from the original Schrodinger equation, by eliminating what's at the boundaries and all that, you could go get to this modified equation, you know, where there's something due to context and there's a source term. Okay? So the first thing I did was, instead of the psi 3, I wrote it that way. The second thing then would be, instead of the psi 0, you'd write this in. Right? So I'll take this off. So instead of psi 0 then, I'll put in e to the power ika psi 1 plus a 1 minus e to the power plus I 2ka. So instead of psi 0, I'm putting that in. So now you see, I could write this new set of equations where you'll notice the thing is, I only have psi 1 and psi 2, my device composed of 2 points, 1 and 2. I've gotten rid of psi 0, psi 3. I really don't need to know what the wave function is in the contacts. Only thing that is left from there is that source term, which is related to the amplitude of the electron wave that came in from the contact. That's it. Otherwise, this is it. So I could write it like this in matrix form, E, psi 1, psi 2, is equal to epsilon minus T0 minus T0 epsilon psi 1 psi 2. So far I've just written this part in matrix form. So this is what you'd have called the H, the Hamiltonian of the device part of it. Epsilon on the diagonal minus T0 on the off diagonal. And now I have a couple of extra terms. So first, let's forget the source term. Let me try to write the one that doesn't involve A. So can you help me what this matrix looks like? This is the A part. So that's the source term part of it. And can you help me with this matrix?
Minus T0
e to the power ik. That's it. Right? And so in terms of this general principle then, I'd have said this is like the H, as we said. That's the sigma. That's the S. Okay? And the sigma has kind of two parts to it, actually. You could say that this 1-1 element came from contact 1. And the 2-2 element came from contact 2. In the sense that if I had taken my device and didn't really have a right-hand contact, only had a left-hand contact, then what would have? Then you wouldn't have got that 2-2 term. So the 2-2 term kind of comes from the right-hand one. So you could say that sigma 1 looks like minus T0 e to the power ika 0, 0, 0. And sigma 2 looks like 0, 0, 0, minus T0 e to the power ika. And, of course, overall sigma, the sum of the two. That's the overall thing. That came from the left contact, that came from the right contact. And the thing is, to keep this kind of manageable, I did it with a 2x2. But this device itself could have been like 50x50. At the end of it, what you would have got is still minus T0 e to the power ik here, and then 49 rows of zeros. And this one would have been like 49 rows of zeros, and then a minus T0 e to the power ik at one corner. That's it. And similarly, the H would have just been this tri-diagonal matrix with epsilons down the diagonal, you know, 50 rows of it, minus T0s on the upper diagonal, minus T0s on the lower diagonal. That's what H would have looked like if the device were like 50 points long. That's it. Okay. Now, the point that needs a little more discussion after this is about what the A is. What is the amplitude of this wave that comes in? So what we got for the S, then, the magnitude, I mean, S is actually the vector, but what I'm writing is just the top component. The only reason we have only a top component is because we assumed electrons coming in from contact 1. If you had assumed electrons coming in from contact 2, you'd have got S2. So what we got is S1. And that is A e to the power So if you took the magnitude squared, yeah. One of the things I'll do right after this I'll explain is that how in a device, in order to get electron density, the tricky point is, the reason Schrodinger equation isn't quite enough is because Schrodinger equation is in terms of size. And when you have multiple sources, you cannot add the size. You have to add the psi star size. And this Gn this electron density, that sort of what it does is, from all the different sources, takes the psi star size and adds them up. So that's kind of what will be where we are going with this. Yes. The right.
Okay, so if you have the matrix is 10 by 10, for example, then this one will have 10.
Right. 10 elements. Then the 10 elements, you'd still have just one non-zero element, and other 9 would be zero.
but there are just two contacts again.
Two contacts. Now, in principle.
What does it mean? How zero is
that? So if you had, say, 10 points, then you have this S1 on top, in this case, and then zeros. So to me, what that physically means is electrons are coming into point one, but when you have contact one, electrons come into point one, though they don't come in anywhere else. Now, in principle, you could have electrons coming into point two directly, in which case you could have had something. Right, but the one at the last will be because of contact two.
Yes.
Right, right. When we consider what comes in from contact two, that's when you'll have the last. And the thing is, now you might say that, you know, why am I doing all this separately? Why don't I just put a S2 here and be done with it? But that's the point I'm trying to make. If you did that, the answer would be wrong, because then you are adding the size from the two sources as if the electrons coming in, because these, remember, these are complex numbers. They have a phase information. If you do this, then what you're really doing is you're saying electrons are coming in from two contacts, and they have a very well-defined phase relationship between them. You know, let's say they're in phase, out of phase, whatever it is. And accordingly, you'll get all kinds of interference terms between them. But reality is that when electrons are coming in from two contacts, their phases are completely random. There's absolutely no interference between two electrons coming from two contacts. And mathematically, if you want to do that, then the way to do it is put a zero here, figure out what it is, square it, then put a S2, have zeros elsewhere, square that, add the squares. Then you wouldn't get these spurious interferences, which don't happen. Okay? Those would happen if the sources were somehow coherent. With light, a similar thing would be happening, that if you had two light bulbs at two ends, you're supposed to add the power. If you had two lasers at two ends, you're supposed to add their electric fields. Right? But usually with light bulbs, and you would add powers. 20 watts and 20 watts make 40 watts. You don't add their electric fields. And psi is kind of like the electric field. Now, with electrons, with normal electrons, you have the equivalent of ordinary thermal sources, like light bulbs. You don't really have the equivalent of a laser. I mean, superconducting electrons would be kind of like that, but where you can actually see interference between two contacts. I mean, Josephson effect is kind of like that. But normal electrons, what we are talking about, there's no interference. Okay. So... Anyway, so with this S1 then, because we are eventually going to square these things and add them, what's really important is this magnitude square, S1 square. That's what's really important. So in this context then, you'll see S1 square is equal to A square times. Now, this one, I think it's best to write this as e to the power ika times e to the power minus ika minus e to the power plus ika. So that this becomes minus 2i sine ka. Now, at this stage, I realize that I probably dropped something, and that is this. I think there should have been a minus T0 here. So can you check and tell me if you think that's true? That minus T0 should have been there. Because if you remember, the way we got the source term was because there was a minus T0 psi 0. Okay? So there should have been a T0 here, just like any place else. Okay? So this should have a minus T0 here. And this then should be whatever I wrote times minus T0. So it will have a 2T0 there. That's all. Okay? Yeah. So when I take the magnitude squared then, this does not matter because this is just a phase factor. Magnitude squared is just plain 1. So it's just the square of this. So S squared is equal to, S1 squared is equal to, let me write that here, A square times 2T0 sine kA square. So that's what I got just by taking the squared magnitude of that. That's all. Now, this is where it's useful to write this in a slightly different way. And that is, if you remember, for the problem we are doing, the EK relationship looks like epsilon minus 2T0 cosine KA. So if you looked at the velocity, that would be, I guess, h bar times the velocity would be dE dK. So can you help me with what that would be? How much is dE dK? 2A T0 sine KA. So what that means is, I could have written this S1 square as A square times this 2T0 sine KA is really just H bar V divided by A. That's it. That's all I was trying to do. Now, this thing is really just like velocity. It is the velocity in this problem. And remember, we are using a discrete lattice model, which matches the continuum thing when Ka is small. And when Ka is small, you can replace sine x with x. And that's how you'd get the usual relation, which is V equals h bar k over m type of thing. That you'd get if you replace the sine with just sine x with just an x, actually. Anyway. Okay. Anyway, so now the important problem, though, is how to figure out the A. And this is where what I was going to argue is the following, that you had this wire here, 1, 2, 0, 3. And you have waves coming in from this contact. Now, if this state is full, and you know this is this A e to the power plus I k x, and if I were to take this wave function and square it, that would give me like the electron density at that point. Now, this electron density, A square, should be equal to, in a given energy range, however, whatever is the density of states, and half of it because I'm only considering the positive going waves. Remember, when we were doing this semi-classical theory, we said there's this density of states divided by 2, and if you multiply it by the velocity, you get the current, etc. So here, it's like in a given energy range, dE, we're looking at half the density of states there. And that then should be the electron density, actually multiplied by whatever the Fermi function of contact 1 happens to be. You know, of course, if there's no Fermi function, no electrons coming in, you'd have put A equals 0. But the strength of the source is proportional to F1, but the way you can find the magnitude of this is by relating it to this. And I write here dE meaning that in a given energy range. And what we are calculating here, by the way, this electron density, current, etc., these are all for a given energy range dE. And if you actually wanted the total electron density or the total current, you integrate over current, integrate over energy. Okay? That's all. I didn't. These are all per unit energies. Okay. So this would be the argument. Now, what is the density of states in a 1D wire? Now, this is an useful result worth remembering. So let me just write this, show this here. Ready. In a 1D wire, if you want to know that in a given density of states, in a given energy range dE, how many states do you have? And the idea is that if you consider a wire of length L, then the states along K are spaced by 2 pi over L. So the number of states in a range dk is equal to dk divided by 2 pi over L. So in any range dk, the number of states you would have is dk divided by this. What we want to know is how many states do I have in a range dE? What I know is if the dE translates to a certain dk, how many states I would have there. So if I want to write this in terms of dE, I'd write this as, I suppose, dE times L over 2 pi dE dk. And then, so this then would be the density of states in a 1D wire. And dE dk is H bar V, always. So, so the density of states is so in a wire of length L, this would be the density of states per unit area. If you drop the L, it's the density of states per unit length. Now, in a discrete model like this, when I take psi A square, what it gives me is the density of states in a region of length A. And so the corresponding density of states here would be like A over this density of states. Now, question is, am I missing a factor of 2? You know, I had written there half d. Should I divide by 2? No. And this discussion, we're not worrying about spin at all. The half was because half the states go forwards, half the states go backwards. Right? Now, the thing is, the way I did this density of states, I only considered the forward-going states anyway. If I really wanted to write the total density of states, I'd also have to consider what happens here. And so the actual density of states in two dimensions would have been twice this. Because you have half of this here and half of this there. Half going forwards, half going backwards. Those are these two lanes, right? And so you could put a 2 there and then remember to divide it by 2. Or, as I said, I just, if you don't write the 2, then whatever is there, that's what I've written here. That's it. That's it. It's over. Okay. So this is basically the argument that I want to go through to say that for a given energy range with a Fermi function F, what should be the amplitude of the incident wave? Okay? That's it. So if I use that, then what I'd get is instead of A square, I'd put dE F1 of E times 2 pi You'll notice I have a A over H bar V And here I had h bar v over a squared, so one of them cancels out, and what you are left with is this. That's the basic. So the strength of this source term squared is d over 2 pi f1 h bar v over a. That's the result I was trying to get at. And this one more thing I'll relate to, and then we're kind of done here. And next day what I'll do is go on to, you know, how, where these equations would come from, how you do that stuff. Because so far what I've showed you is that starting from the regular Schrodinger equation, you could turn it into something looking like this with a damping term and a source term. It's almost like you have this LC circuit. This much is like an LC circuit. When you connect it to something, there's a source resistance, and then there's a voltage source. It's almost like that. Right? LC, damping, source, in a way. Right? Now, so there's one more thing I wanted to relate clearly, and that is this H bar V over A. This, you notice, is the strength of the source then depends on Fermi function. That's, you'd expect it from common sense. I mean, after all, if there's no electrons there, you don't expect a source. But then it also depends on this H bar V over A. So what's the significance of that? Now, this is where I wanted to point out that if you look at the imaginary part of this, so what that means is, you know, earlier I had said that there is this sigma, which is a complex quantity, and the gamma is like this anti-Hermitian part of the matrix, which if this is a number, we are talking of the imaginary part of that, basically. So if sigma is minus T0 e to the power ika, question is, what is gamma? What is the corresponding gamma? So let's say we're talking of sigma 1. The corresponding gamma 1 is I times minus T0 e to the power ika. So, you know, sigma minus sigma dagger. Can you help me with what I should write for minus sigma dagger? Plus T0 e to the power minus IKA. Right? I mean, it is minus minus that, so that's the plus. So you'll notice this then becomes, how much is this? 2I, or 2 T0 sine KA. Which, you know, just a while back, I went through this argument as to why this is H bar V over A. There's a velocity as that's d dk. That was this 2A T0 sine k, etc. So you'll notice this H bar V over A, it's also the imaginary part of sigma, which is like the damping term, which basically tells you how easily electrons can get out of the device. And it would seem reasonable that that should be H bar V over A. After all, if you have a wire like there, and you have connected it to a contact, and you ask the question, an electron here, how easily will it leak out into the contact? You'd say, well, you know, H bar V is the velocity with which it exits. So how long does it take to empty out something of length A? That would be like H bar V over A. So you can kind of see why you'd expect gamma to be like H bar V over A. But more importantly, what it also shows is that the strength of the source term is actually proportional to the damping. So it is sort of like any time you connect your device strongly to the contacts, of course, sigma has a big imaginary part because electrons can get out very easily. That's a high damping. But the source is also stronger because it can get out easily, but what that means is things can come in easily also. So in that sense, the strength of the source term, instead of this, I could have written something like gamma 1, the magnitude of gamma 1. So in general, this is something you'll see, that the strength of the source term, you know, here we did a rather simple model, just a 1D wire. But even if you had a very complicated contact, the general relationship is that the strength of the source term is proportional to the damping due to that contact times the Fermi function. regardless of the complicated details. Because, as I said earlier, we are doing a simple problem, but finally we are trying to get at equations which are really quite general and would handle very complicated devices and contacts also. In principle, these are all valid, no matter how complicated it is, actually. Okay? So let me stop here today and finish this up next day.